I think I read, yes, it was on the PBS NewsHour. I think they said the Indian government, the country of India, is sending a spacecraft that's going to be circling Mars and taking measurements. So that was a brand new one, me. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Companies that were looking to become transports to the International Space Station for NASA. You know, which one was going to win, or was it going to be more than one? And I was hoping for, you know, a couple of them. And sure enough, two of them, two out of the four did win. And that was Boeing and SpaceX. No surprise there for SpaceX. I mean, they've been doing a terrific job. They've been launching cargo on a regular basis to the International Space Station. They've been bringing stuff back from the space station. Right now, they're the only American spacecraft that could re-enter the atmosphere and bring scientific equipment back. We have another one by Orbital Science that goes up on a regular basis now, and that's the Cygnus spacecraft. And that one doesn't come back. You know, that one burns up over the Pacific Ocean every time it sends one up, one cargo vessel up. But these are very big contracts that they won. It's you know, a total of $6.8 billion. Boeing got 4.2, and SpaceX got almost $3 billion. So big contracts to develop their craft to bring crews. You know, they had similar deals for cargo. That's why they're bringing cargo up to the space station now on SpaceX and Orbital Science. They had almost $2 billion contracts, 1.6, I think that was the contract for that. But these are...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
These are big multi-billion dollar contracts to have these private companies, Boeing and SpaceX, continue to build their vehicles. SpaceX has the crewed Dragon version. They send the Dragon up now to the space station. In fact, they launched one last night. I stayed up and watched that one off at almost 2 o'clock, 1:52 in the morning to the International Space Station. Well, they have a crewed version they're working on, and this money is going to help them develop that, and they'll be able to send astronauts to the International Space Station, and even to on private missions, not to the space station, or maybe even eventually to the eventually the Bigelow spacecraft that they plan on building. Bigelow space station, correction. And same with Boeing, they have the CST-100. I drop it. WS2N, they have the CST-100 that they're building. They'll be able to send seven people up in that and return the crew. And these vehicles can stay in orbit for a long time. They don't have to go up for a couple of weeks and come back like the space shuttle did. They could stay up for almost a year, 260 to 70 days or something, for Boeing, for instance. So, which means that they'll be able to increase the size of the crews on the International Space Station. Right now, you have a standard crew of six. Right now, it's three because they just sent three back. But in another month or so, they'll be sending up another three. So generally it's six, and you need to have lifeboats up there. So when the six are up there, they have two Soyuz spacecraft to escape. Well, when Dragon gets going and they want to bring up three or more people, same for Boeing. Once they're attached to the space station, they can just stay there. And you could have a crew, for instance, of nine with no problem. So, there you go. So that worked out pretty good. The other two that didn't get the contract, I was hoping Sierra Nevada would get it. They're the ones with Dream Chaser. They've been building their spacecraft, and that would looks like a small space shuttle that will eventually land on land. But I don't feel sorry for them because they're still going to keep building that thing. And in fact, they're working out deals with Japan. And maybe eventually they'll be launching from their launch site. The other one, Blue Origin. I don't talk much about them because they keep a lot of their work relatively quiet. Blue Origin does. And They've been working on a suborbital rocket that will be able to go up into space and then come right back down. And that's called the New Shepard, with eventual plans of, you know, increasing that, the power of the engines, and making it where it could become eventually orbital. Well, they got a contract with Boeing. They signed up with Boeing. And they're going to, they right now they have a new engine that's been developed called the BE-3, and which has been doing terrific, plenty of test firings, and very good rocket. They're going to develop the BE-4 for Boeing, and by 2017, let me drop it. Those particular rocket engines could be ready. And they will eventually replace what Boeing is and Lockheed have been using. They're called the United Launch Alliance. That's Lockheed and Boeing. They're the ones that launched the Atlas V with the Russian-made rockets. And everybody's talking about, well, these Russian-made rockets by 2017 will be completely replaced by the BE-3 being built by Blue Origin. So. I know it's a lot to take in, Dick, but there's more things I have to cover, but I think it's just too much for one night. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N for the Space Report. Any questions?
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions. I'm hearing that these new contracts being let to various people sound to me like the total contract is in the billions of dollars. The good news of these contracts is that it's providing redundancy, alternation, more than one source for launch craft, greater number of humans can be transported simultaneously. We're getting all kinds of advantages out of that. However, if you look at the total dollars spent versus capability, if I backtrack to the Space Shuttle, which was around $2.25 billion per copy for the spacecraft. The spacecraft itself, from my point of view, was a very reliable spacecraft, except for one nasty characteristic. If you launched on the second day, as opposed to the first day, and you got the cryogenic materials on the external tank all of that time, and the cryogenic materials with their supercooling are creating what's called cryopumping. In other words, any air that comes in contact with the insulating foam on the outside, any air that drips through that foam, touches the cryogenically cooled metal surface on the outside of the tank, that air turns into liquid. Any moisture in it turns into ice. And so therefore you've got a continuous buildup of ice in the foam. And if the ice breaks off and hits the wing, you know what happens. So that's the one danger. That was the one Achilles heel. That was the weak point of the space shuttle. Let me drop. So, in order to stop that from happening, you have to stop cryopumping. Okay? A number of techniques were tried to stop the air hitting the foam with air moisture and Florida high humidity air turning into ice and turning into liquid air. And therefore you build up the stuff in the foam, which eventually breaks away, and a chunk of frozen foam with ice in it hitting a wing can certainly do a hell of a lot of damage, as we know what happened with Challenger. As such, Challenger and also Columbia, both of them suffered problems of, Challenger was the O-ring seal problem, but Columbia was the chunk of ice. And by the way, various chunks of ice were hitting the tail feathers of solid rocket boosters for years, and various spacecraft, space shuttles, when they came back down, showed chunks of ice had hit thermal insulating tiles, and so we hit it kind of lucky for a while. The only thing that was required is to stop cryopumping. Now I'm going to propose something that's really hokey. Let me drop. You want to fill the airspace around the foam when it's on the launch pad with something that will not turn into a liquid and does not contain moisture. I'm going to say something really hokey. If I simply put a plastic bag, I'm literally talking about something that's not much heavier than the plastic you've got from your dry cleaner. I put a plastic bag over the external tank while it's on the launch pad, and I pump helium into it. Any helium that comes in contact with the cryogenic oxygen and hydrogen in the tank will not turn into a liquid, because the helium has a liquefying temperature of 4 degrees Kelvin, and liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen are running more like 50 degrees Kelvin. So it's much too warm for the helium. The helium that you're pumping into the plastic bag that's on the outside of the space shuttle has no moisture. You're pumping in dry helium, and the helium won't turn into liquid. So therefore, you're not forming liquid air, you're not forming ice, and this very flimsy plastic bag that you're pumping helium into to keep the foam nice and fresh so it doesn't have all this frozen stuff inside, as soon as you blast off, this very light plastic bag has no strength to it. It simply blows away. As hokey as that sounds, would that have been a solution? Could we have been using the space shuttle to this day? I know it sounds crazy. What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of venting that goes on, though. You know, you got to do something with that. You know, get that all past your plastic bag. I guess you can come up with something, Dick. I mean, if you're going to come up with a bag that's going to probably weigh 1,000 pounds, you know, they don't like weight. And you say, well, it's not going to cost weigh 1,000 pounds. Just the white paint on, remember the white paint on the first, on Columbia, on the external tank that they had? They showed the original launch of the Columbia. Actually the second launch, but after that they did away with the white paint. Why did they do away with the white paint? That boy, I really looked neat when it went up. It's because just the paint alone weighed 600 pounds. So I don't know if weight would become a factor here, Dick. But I guess it's worth it to exchange the weight for the safety value. But what they got coming up next, you'll have these heavy lifted vehicles. You're going to have NASA's version of the space program, which is going to be these heavy lift space launch systems. Let me drop it.
And also take
with 70-ton payloads, and then you're going to work your way up right after that, the larger version of the 130-ton payloads. These are heavier than what the Saturn V used to be able to bring up. So, I mean, if they want to build another space station or something, or add parts, you know, they'll have no problem with that thing. Because they have plans of, using the space launch system. You know, sure, it's going to be manned. That's the main thing for it. But you will be able to use it for unmanned projects. For instance, you'll be able to send stuff up into space, into orbit, big stuff, or you can send even very fast missions to Europa. That's one plan that they have. They want to get to Europa and dig through the ice. So you got NASA's version of the space program, and then you got the commercial version. This money is supporting the commercial version, which is basically transport crews to the International Space Station until at least 2025. Right now it's funded until that time, and you know what's going to happen. It's going to go on after that. The companies themselves are allowed to use their spacecraft, which are going to be reusable up to 10 times each, for other missions going to the future Bigelow Space Station, or just plain science missions for NASA or DARPA. Or even for private companies, they're allowed to use the same spacecraft that they're getting seed money for these purposes. So the idea is to lower the cost of space, trying to get.
You guys are going to turn it over to him in a second. When it comes to the venting, yes, you've got continuous oxygen and hydrogen boiling off on those tanks, and they come out a very specific venting tube, and you don't put the plastic bag over those tubes. The plastic bag itself, as I said, a very flimsy plastic that once the spacecraft moves, it gets ripped away immediately. And if you want to make double damn sure it gets ripped away, you connect a lanyard to the tip of the plastic bag, which goes down to the ground, and it's got a wind-up mechanism. So just you fired up your engines, you're ready to blast off. You turn on the reeling mechanism that reels in that lanyard that yanks the plastic bag down and rips it away from the external tank. And the only reason for the plastic bag is something that you blow helium into, so that the helium coming in contact with your foam is not carrying moisture and liquefying air, and therefore the foam stays virgin, if you know what I mean. Back in the days when they did have that 1,000 pounds of paint on the foam, that was one more layer of protection, as I see it, John, where it kept the air away from the foam. You didn't have air drifting into the foam because the paint was one more layer on the outside of the foam. I think they sacrificed some of the insulating properties of the foam. They thought they were saving 1,000 pounds of weight by eliminating the paint. I think they really didn't. Let me drop. I think they were making the foam more vulnerable to sucking up moisture and air when the paint wasn't there. And you could have used a kind of paint that has a slippery substance on the outside where the ice will not form on the paint. It'll peel away, if you know what I mean. So I think there could have been ways of increasing the insulation between the inner tanks of oxygen and hydrogen and the outer containment of the external tank. There could have been ways of insulating that airspace so you don't form frozen water, ice, and liquefied air on the outside. I guarantee there were ways of fixing that. They just didn't hit the right combination with the right people that had the right kind of crazy thinking, as I see it. KC2WGB, K2RIW, what would you have done to fix this up, John, if it was your program?
Good question, Dick. But no, I support your view. I think that, don't forget, the only insulation required would be above the actual craft itself, so you don't have to insulate that whole column of tubing. And the vents itself, they could even just put extension tubes on them. And as you said, they could be pulled off as the launch goes up. So I think there's a couple of variations they could do to reduce that danger, absolutely.
Hey, John, you just hit something. Let me drop this. Airborne Instruments Laboratory had a very similar problem in roughly 1967. They had just invented a thing called the hot-cold noise source. There's a pair of 50-ohm resistors in this package, very precise 50-ohm resistors, 50 ohms DC to light, with a then state-of-the-art connector, which was called a GR974, the sexless connector. So you take the input connector to your low-noise amplifier that you want to measure. You first take the sexless connector and connect it into the 50-ohm load that has liquid nitrogen boiling away on it. And so that one had 77 degrees Kelvin. The second 50-ohm resistor, you unplugged from the first one and plugged into the second one. The second 50-ohm resistor had a heater in there that brought it up to exactly 100 degrees centigrade. The difference between the noise output of a 50-ohm resistor that's cryogenically cooled to 77 Kelvin versus one that's 390 Kelvin is a very specific amount. I think it's 3.5 decibels of difference in noise power. And so that ratio of noise power is called the Y factor. If your preamplifier was perfect, you saw exactly 3.5 dB of difference in noise power coming out of your amplifier. As your amplifier gets noisier and noisier, it can't see that ratio anymore, and you get a lower and lower number. And you go to the right lookup graph, or you go to the equation, and it tells you what is the noise figure. The most reliable, arguably the most reliable, very low noise amplifier noise figure confirming procedure was the hot cold procedure. That's the good news. I think that was invented by Dr. John Clark, who eventually became a president of AIL. Let me drop. But they had a problem, and that is the resistor that was being cooled with liquid nitrogen was an air line that went out to the GR connector. As air from the outside world poured down that line, the air became liquefied. Therefore, you had liquid air alongside of the 50-ohm resistor, and the 50-ohm resistor saw the capacitance of the liquid air, and it wasn't a 50-ohm resistor anymore. It was a 50-ohm resistor with a shunt capacitor, and it wasn't a good load. A genius named Hobby Glass said, hey, we've got liquid nitrogen boiling away from the liquid nitrogen doer that's keeping the resistor cold. Why don't we take the liquid nitrogen that's being turned into nitrogen as it boils away and pour the nitrogen into the 50-ohm resistor environment? Now it's got continuous outgassing of dry nitrogen. It's the dry nitrogen that you put in there in the liquid form. So using the outgassing as an advantage to stop the air from getting in there and doing cryopumping, okay? In the case of the space shuttle, you've got liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen continuously boiling away. These are thoroughly dry. There is no water in that liquid oxygen tank, and there is no water in that liquid oxygen tank. As they boil away, that could be the dry gas that's filling the plastic bag on the outside of the space shuttle's external tank, and now you have no moisture coming in contact with the foam. The foam is staying virgin. They had the experiment. They had the answer right there. The boil-off was the answer. Ain't that something? And just like John said, you only had to protect the nose of the external tank. As you get below the wing area, there's no way that the foam dropping away could hit the wing. You'd have to go a little bit further because some of the foam chunks breaking away were hitting the lower skirt on the solid repeater.
Time out.
Now, chunks of icy foam hitting the skirt of the bottom of the solid rocket boosters, that wasn't a showstopper. It was just making dents, and it was ugly looking. It was maybe changing the aerodynamics a little bit. But hitting a chunk of ice, hitting the leading edge of your carbon-carbon reinforced material, that, of course, is lethal. So the boil-off oxygen and the boil-off hydrogen could have kept the foam from absorbing any liquid air or any moisture. The solution was there. KC2 WGB. I mean, WS2N K2RIW. Over to you, Paul.
Okay, yeah. I really never remember exactly hearing that it was definitely the moisture inside the insulation, you know, that went through the carbon-carbon. I know they ran tests with the insulation itself, and that's what was breaking off. And the insulation was, you know, they shot it out of these air cannons, and they didn't shoot it out with, you know, they didn't take these pieces of insulation, soak it in water, and then freeze it, and then shoot it out of the cannon. They just took the insulation itself, so it was actually pieces of insulation breaking off, I think, due to the maybe the freezing of the and the you know, contraction and everything from cold, you know, breaking these pieces off. I think it had something to do with that. But with the SLS system, you won't have any problems with that. You're going to have the spacecraft above the you know, at the top, similar to what you have with Apollo and Gemini and Mercury. And you're going to have the same with Boeing's, and the same with the Dragon, and even with the Dream Chaser. When they plan on launching that right now, the present plan was to put it on top, coming out with 5 rockets, so it's right at the very tippy top. Let me drop it 1 sec.
Yeah, I'm going to add a couple words to this one, Paul.
Right now you have a successful system going with the X-37B. It's a military spacecraft that's been in orbit for over a year now. They launched that on an Atlas V. And they, instead of doing what Dream Chaser wanted to do, which was just put the whole winged spacecraft on top of the Atlas and launch into space. The X-37, that's military, it's top secret. You know, it goes up and it comes back and lands like the shuttle out in California. That thing is encapsulated in fairings at the top of the Atlas V, and that's how that thing is launched. The fairings separating, and this winged vehicle does all the spy work and comes back a year and a half later. They've launched it a couple of times already. Back to you, Dick. WSOM.
Even if the bomb didn't contain ice, and I think some of it definitely did, obvious by the damage it did when it hit the skirt of the solid rocket booster, something very massive was hitting. Just light foam wouldn't have created that dent in that metal structure on the skirt of the SRB. The foam itself was very well attached. That's the good news. The bad news is that anything that got into the fibers of the foam, into the airspace of the foam, whether it be liquefied air, frozen water, liquefied nitrogen, liquefied anything, when it's in the foam and you blast off into space, you're going to an area of lower air pressure and you're getting significant external heating. The air going by at Mach 3, 5, 7, whatever, is creating heating. Therefore, any liquefied air or moisture that's in the foam is going to boil off. And if it's at the bottom of the foam, where the foam is attached to the metal structure of the external tank, that foam, that the substance is boiling off, is doing a tremendous amount of outgassing, and it breaks away the foam. So anything that becomes liquefied in the vicinity of the foam can give you damage downrange and make the foam break away. So you have to stop that from happening. Whichever one of those gases is boiling off, whether it be the liquid oxygen or the liquid hydrogen, whichever one has the lowest boil-off temperature is the one that, as it's boiling off, could be directed into a plastic bag around the foam on the outside, keeping the foam pristine. The foam is running warmer than the fluid inside the tank, and the liquid hydrogen boiling off is giving you pure hydrogen. The pure hydrogen is completely dry. There's no moisture in it. So now you're blowing dry nitrogen across the foam if it's inside the plastic bag. And the plastic bag doesn't...
Repeater, timeout.
The plastic bag, that doesn't have to be substantial in any way. It can be a very flimsy thing. It just means that... it just makes sure that nothing but, we'll say, hydrogen gas is in contact with the foam. That's all the plastic bag has to do. That can be very flimsy, easily ripped away at the instant that you do the launch. They had the materials there to solve the problem, from my point of view. I'll admit it's a little bit hokey, a little bit naive, but you have to stop the foam from soaking up anything that turns into a liquid. Because when it boils off, when you're going into space, as you're passing by Mach 2 and 3 and getting a lot of external heating, the bubbling away of that substance is going to break away the foam. You want to make sure there's nothing there that the gaseous hydrogen, will say, or helium, whichever you like. Over to you, Paul. Oh, what was that, John? Yeah, go ahead, John.
At what period from the launch does the foam strike happen? Is it the first minute, do you know, or is it the first 30 seconds? What's the time frame, do you know?
They have high-speed photography of the blast-off of Columbia, and they had a whole lot of stop action of that foam breaking away, hitting the leading edge, and then blasting into a whole bunch of fine particles after it hit the leading edge. And I think that was something like 19 seconds after launch. Yeah, I think it was 19 seconds after launch. 19 seconds after launch, the craft is moving probably at Mach 2. It's getting enough heating and vibration that whatever is now soaked in the foam is boiling off, and the outgassing of that substance, whether it be air or moisture, doesn't matter, is now bubbling on the bottom of the foam, making it break away, and the foam now contains some amount of liquid air and or moisture, and the chunk of foam hitting the leading edge can do a hell of a lot of damage. Over to you, John.
B2WGB. Well, Dick, what about microventing the foam so pressure could be relieved through the microvents and not affect the insulation value of the foam much, or also putting failure points in the foam, like every square inch, so that if the foam is exploded off of the fuselage, it will break up. I mean, there are quite a few things. Maybe they've tried all of this, but I think there's definitely something can be done about it. The micro-venting was done. They did take a object that had a whole bunch of long, spiky things to it and stabbed the foam with this in order to give it channels of outgassing. Sounds good on paper. The problem is those channels you just created, while you're sitting on the launch pad for 24 hours with cryogenic fluids inside, the air is pouring down those channels and being liquefied, and that air is carrying flour to moisture in with it. So the channels of outgassing that you created, the channels that you thought was going to relieve the problem, aggravated the problem. So any kind of air going down through the foam into the cryogenically cooled metal of the outer surface of the tank is going to give you grief. You have to make sure that anything goes down there is a gaseous substance that will not liquefy at those temperatures, and it's got to be a gaseous substance that contains no moisture. If there was nothing but dry nitrogen in the gaseous form down inside your foam, that's not going to give you grief. Anything that's liquid, because when you take any liquid and you boil it up from the liquid state to the gaseous state, you get a 1,000-to-1 volume increase. So anything that's liquid that becomes a gas becomes 1,000 times more voluminous, and that inflation is going to break away your foam. You see what's going on there, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay. Very good. Yep. So the moisture in the air is actually freezing and defeating the purpose of the vent holes.
All right.
Understood. Thank you, Dick.
Even more than just moisture. Let me drop it. The vent holes are allowing air to go down there. Air is bad because at liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen temperature, air turns into a liquid. They call it cryopumping because you can take, let me pick a number, a cubic meter of air, let it slowly go down those air venting channels, let it turn into a liquid, where now the cubic meter of air is a couple of centimeters of cubic centimeters of liquid air. And it's sitting there in the foam. And as soon as you blast off, 19 seconds later, when you get a hell of a lot of external heating and or lower air pressure, that liquid air turning back into a gas is going to give you grief. You have to make sure that anything that goes down into the foam is non-liquefiable and dry. And the liquid hydrogen boiling off from the tank fulfills that requirement. It's a material that it can't be liquefied unless it's down to a super low temperature, and it contains no moisture. So if nothing but hydrogen was in the vicinity of the foam inside the plastic bag, then the foam would be kept safe, in my opinion. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Very good. Very good, Dick. Yeah, sounds plausible. You know, it makes me wonder, we only lose, I don't know how much percentage of foam or the greatest percentage of foam that has blown off, but it makes you wonder why certain areas, why don't they maybe make that a weaker construction or something like that, because if it's generally applied, it should all be blowing off, and it's not. So if it's coming through by the air migrating through the foam. Just endless questions, Dick.
A high percentage of the foam fracture took place at a very specific knuckle that was on the outside of the external tank. That knuckle was part of the mounting structure. That knuckle was a chunk of, let me pick a name. It probably was an aluminum alloy that was part of the mounting structure that went between the external tank and the rest of the craft. That knuckle had to be there for strength reasons. But that knuckle is now a chunk of aluminum alloy in intimate thermal contact with the rest of the skin of the external tank. And the external tank itself is in close thermal contact with the liquefied oxygen and hydrogen that's on the inside of the tank. So that hold-on knuckle,
became a great big thermal finger of cryogenically cooled aluminum, and any method of trying to put foam on that knuckle is going to give you grief. I think the majority of the foam is breaking off from that knuckle. And they did all kinds of experiments to try to stop the foam from breaking away from that knuckle. Well, no matter what you do, no matter how the foam is attached, let me drop. If there's 1 cubic centimeter of liquefied air of any kind inside of that foam on that knuckle, and that cubic centimeter of air, when it becomes gaseous because of heating and lower external pressure, when it becomes gaseous, it's going to expand by 1,000 to 1. IW.
Yeah, if you look at the original Saturn V launches, and a lot of times there's a close-up view, there is thousands and thousands of pieces of actual ice coming off. It's not foam, it's ice, as they launch, and that's what that is. And you know, even with the bag around it, the bag's going to get cold. Ice is going to stick to the bag. You're not going to shake the ice from. So it might help on the foam, but you're still not going to shake the ice from. And they know it. And the cost of the shuttle. I mean, each flight. And these things were supposed to. They were designed in the 70s to go up. They were going to be sending these things up. You know, once a week. You know, that's what they planned on doing. And the most they ever got off, I think, in 1 year was nine missions. And each one was in the $400 to $500 million, half a billion dollar launches. They had to refurbish so much stuff every time it landed. So, there's a lot of reasons it was canceled. It wasn't just a bomb. They knew they had problems. That they didn't want to deal with anymore, and they didn't need it. They didn't need to bring up large pieces of structure to the space station. Remember, before the space station, there were people complaining left and right, taxpayers, that you have these shuttles going up and they're just going around the Earth and coming back and landing. They were going nowhere, so the space station gave them a place to go to. And NASA was very happy when this $100 billion home in space was approved with the help of 16 other countries. So it gave them a reason to use it. Now that it's really built, it's up there. There's no plans of putting another one up anytime soon, although China is thinking about it. Bigelow is doing it on their own with these inflatable ones. You won't need, or you don't need space shuttles to go up to low Earth orbit to fly around and come back if you don't have a place to visit. Now, the only thing you need is crews and some supplies now, and that's being handled. It'll be handled in the future, starting in 2017 with the first flights to the space station by private companies. WS2M.
Another quick comment, Dick.
Yeah, I want to ask him a question about Viking in a minute, but go ahead, John.
It just brings me to mind when we were doing some pipe work, there was a thing they used. I wondered if they had a specific location where they had a greater amount of failures, if they could have taken possibly a millimeter off of the thickness of the insulation and put a webbing, monofilament like nylon or something like that, and maybe half-inch square structure, and wrap it with that. I wonder if that would have prevented large chunks from coming off. What do you think of that, Dick? Back to you.
Pipe covering, John. Very good.
Dick, you described this pipe covering. In other words, by way of putting some kind of a covering on the outside of the foam insulation, I think you're saying it's bound into place and it can't possibly leave. Is that what you're saying, John?
That's correct. And if it was a nylon filament base, like some of the monofilaments, it's extremely strong. It wouldn't weigh anymore because you would be moving, say, a millimeter, and then you look at the diameter of your cord that you're going to be using. That might be effective.
It sounds like it's good and strong, but I'm a little bit wary when it comes to the total area.
it's going to be heavier than the paint. And they tried eliminating the paint because of its weight. I'm beginning to think, though, that, John, they may have been penny-wise, pound-foolish. I mean, Paul. They may have been penny-wise, pound-foolish with eliminating the paint. I think the paint was one more layer of insulation of quasi-airtight tight material, both holding the foam together. The paint was a nice, strong substance, like an epoxy paint. It could have been quasi-airtight and also one more layer of strong stuff holding the foam in. Over to you on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
I agree with paint. I mean, we talked about paint years ago. At least I talked to somebody about it, but it was a shame they did away with it. Not only did it look good, it probably did have some functionality. Although I don't think they knew that at the time. But John's idea with this pipe covering, I mean, you put this on, you know, you can put it on any size pipe you want. And in fact, they wrap it with this material that John's talking about, and then they coat it with this, I'm not going to call it asbestos. They don't use it anymore, but asbestos-like material. And this stuff, I mean, you have to bang through with a hammer to cut through this stuff. It's very durable. But I think the weight would have been prohibitive. But definitely more than paint. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
Yeah, the majority of what you were telling us tonight is more missions to Mars. Let's see, Carl Sagan was heavily involved in selecting the landing site and the design of the craft and whatever for the two Viking craft, and I think both Viking craft landed on Mars either 1975 or 1976, 39 years ago. Boy, we've been visiting Mars a lot. We've been on the Mars surface for roughly 39 years, but before that, the Mariner flyby. I'm not sure the exact year, you're going to tell me. We had a Mariner that flew by Venus. We had a Mariner that flew by Mars. The very first picture of Mars.
1960, by the way.
1960 what? What was that again?
1961 was Mariner 4.
Wow. 19. Our very first real close-up picture of Mars, where you didn't have these beautiful canals that were transporting water and making vegetation in the summertime, is what we used to believe. I can't remember that astronomer's name that started that all off. Anyhow, 1961. Wow. So 1961 is 40. That's 53 years ago. We've been visiting Mars for 53 years, if you include Mariner 4. The total number of missions to Mars.
40. A little over 40.
40 missions to Mars. And the majority of those are both Soviet and the United States. Is that true? Did anybody else... Right now, you've got India going to Mars. But did anybody else but the U.S. and Russia go to Mars? China is probably also talking to Mars. Over to you on that one, Paul.
They tried it. It didn't work out for them. They launched on a Russian rocket. The Japanese tried it. It got close to... Mars, but I don't think the retro rocket is fired or something. She just kept on going, and right now it's in solar orbit. That one didn't work out. But the other country, it's a group of countries, it's the European Space Agency. They have successfully gone to Mars. For instance, they have an active orbiting spacecraft right now called Mars Express, and they also have one called Venus Express, by the way. They have one. Going around Venus. So this would be the fourth entity, fourth country, I'm going to call it, that has done this. Hopefully it works out. They'll be the first country to succeed on the first try if they make it. We didn't succeed on our first try. Neither did the Russians. Back to you there.
Well, Viking was successful. The very first landing was successful the very first try, as I see it. And Mariner was only a flyby in 1961, you said, Mariner 4. So as a flyby, it was successful. What did we do in between that was not successful, Paul? Go ahead.
Mariner 3 was supposed to go. That didn't make it. Mariner 4 made it. Was a flyby. Mariner 9 was the orbital mission. That got there, and it was cloud cover. I mean, for months, it finally cleared up. It was a global problem on Mars, and then they finally got pictures later on. We've had failures. We've had the Mars Polar Lander, Mars Climate Orbiter failed. Mars Orbiter. That's a similar thing to what happened to Japan. They think that wound up in solar orbit. That one didn't work out in 1999. So we've had some failures, but we've had plenty of successes. As you said, the Vikings, two of them, one on one side of the planet and the other one on the other. They operated one for 6 years, the other one for 8 years, because they had RTGs on board. And don't forget, both those missions had two orbiters that went with them. So they actually, those things are still in orbit around Mars, not functioning. Back to you, Dick.
If we add up all of the craft that either desired to go to Mars landing, desired to go to Mars orbit, and succeeded, the total number of craft of all the countries involved is a pretty big number. As a planet, Earth, we've made a fairly big investment in Mars and looking for life. It's the most likely place in our solar system where life could have occurred. My goodness, have we made an investment in Mars? And we're not even slowing down on this one, are we, Paul? WS2N, K2RH, there's more where this came from.
Yeah, not even a little bit. a little over 40 missions, I think, roughly 9 have failed or something. Russia had a, I think they called it Mars 1, and it landed and transmitted for about 10 seconds, and that was it. And they didn't get any useful science out of it at all, not even a temperature reading or anything, so they consider that one a failure. So we were the first ones to land successfully with the Viking missions. And we had scoops on there, and we were able to analyze the soil. It wasn't able to ride around. The first one we could ride around on successfully was the Pathfinder that landed, and it had a little rover called Sojourner, the size of a microwave oven, and that was successful. Previous before that, the Russians, not the Russians, the European Space Agency tried to land a rover called Beagle 2. Beagle 2. And it landed, but they never heard from it. So, although they did find it, one of the spacecraft in orbit has a high-rise telescope looking down at the planet. It's called, that's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and I took pictures of the Beagle. I actually saw the Beagle on the ground, so it never worked out. So, a little over 40 missions to Mars, and a lot more to come when we drop it. We have InSight going up in 2016. And it's got a big seismometer on there, and it's going to drill, I don't know, 30 feet to the ground or something. That's paid for. We're ready to go. 2016. You've got the European Space Agency is launching two vehicles in 2016, I think, and then two more in 2018 or 19. One of them will be a rover, solar-powered. And then we also have scheduled a rover to go in 2020, and that's going to they call it the 2020 rover, but eventually that'll have a name like Curiosity, and that's going to land very similar to Curiosity with the Sky Crane, and there's a few more that that are on the books that aren't being funded yet that they'd like to do. Back to you, Dick.
Boy, that's a lot of Mars investigation. In total number of dollars, man hours, or whatever, we've invested in Mars. Wow. And I think we've been very pleasantly surprised at the total amount of water on Mars in frozen ice form below the surface. We've been disappointed by the atmosphere. It's got, less than 1% of our atmosphere pressure, and it's post primarily carbon dioxide because of a lack of a magnetic field in the last zillion years, last 2 million years. The solar wind has been peeling away the atmosphere. So, it could have had life earlier. Could that life earlier have been, let me pick a number, 3 million years ago? And with all of that high wind blowing across that surface, with all that atmosphere being peeled away, are you going to see any evidence left over of that life that may have been there 1 million years ago in Mars's earlier time frame, when maybe it was warmer and had real greenhouse effect? Let me drop it. So, I think one of our major motivations on all of this Mars investigation is to look for the evidence of early life having been there at one time. It would be very strong evidence that life as we know it is universal. It doesn't have to be seeded from one planet to another. And even if that did take place, where did life begin in the first place? I mean, the Stanley Miller experiment, to me, is a pretty strong chunk of evidence that if you've got the right condition, life will form every time. It has no choice. Every reaction is not forbidden, it's compulsory. If you've got enough material reacting for a long enough period of time under the right conditions. And right now we know of more than 1,000 exoplanets just from the Kepler mission, which just looked at a tiny little chunk of space. A good reason to believe, let me drop this. Good reason to believe that since this galaxy that we're in contains something like 300 billion stars, and if you count the total number of planets per star, it's probably above unity. I mean, some stars have got a whole bunch of planets, and maybe once in a while you get a star with no planets. So we probably have 300 billion planets in this galaxy. Boy, that's a lot of opportunity as I see it. There's got to be life out there. WS2N, KQLAW.
I don't know if they're going to find it in our lifetime, but, you know, everything could have been wiped off the face of that planet Mars. You know, we found meteorites here that were from Mars. Asteroids blasted into the Mars surface, and, you know, maybe 50,000 or a million years later, it's a piece of rock that flew off from Mars lands in Antarctic, and then somebody comes along in 1984 and picks it up, and they analyze it, and they think they can find traces of microbes, you know, microbe fossils inside. I mean, you know, if we go there and we find more of the same, everybody's going to say, well, the same thing happened, you know, we got hit by a big asteroid or something, and the pieces flew off from Earth and travel to Mars. But just the idea that something biological could somehow survive the trip between the two planets, that tells me, could it survive the trip between here and Europa or another star system? So, you know, could seeding be going on throughout the whole galaxy? I don't know. I don't know if we're gonna get an answer anytime soon, Dick. But it's sure fun trying to find out. KQRIWWS.
I'm in.
You got it, John.
Yeah, Paul and Dick. I think it's going to be interesting when they drill into that comet. Eventually, they want to bring some of the stuff back. They'll probably be doing that with comets too. It'll be very interesting to see what we find. Now, if it's on a comet or if it's on an asteroid, that'd be extremely interesting.
Yeah, the stuff being brought back from a comet or an asteroid quite possibly will contain amino acids, basic building blocks of life. I think there's lots and lots of evidence that building the amino acids from inert, seemingly inert raw materials is pretty easy. That's what the Stanley Miller experiment did. So the suggestion is that if you're doing this in a flask, in a laboratory, so to speak, and you wait long enough, you'd like to believe that life will eventually crawl out of the flask. Or when you got